Hello, good people, and welcome to the Alchemy of Light broadcast. I am Jamil Graham, your host, and the Alchemy of Light broadcast is a celebration and exploration of feelings because everything begins with a feeling. And today we have a very special guest, Lauren Murray. She is a very special guest for many reasons. The life path that she has walked is an example and a testimony for all of us of how we can make that little shift to live closer to our heart, closer to our soul, closer to what we know is right, and survive and make it work and go through all of those changes that happen and know that somehow it is okay. And people like Lauren are a very important part, I feel, in this particular time of our evolution in the Earth sphere as human beings, as we have seen all around us and continue to see all around us, our systems collapsing, the veil thinning, the awareness of things as we once knew them, just not the way we once knew them, the truth or whatever level we're at, looking at that, changing, moving around, everything shifting so much. It leaves us feeling very, or it can possibly leave us feeling very unsure of even who we are and what to be in the world. And people like Lauren are an example that somehow finding your truth inside yourself is a really reliable compass in times like these. And so she is warmed up. She is really on the path. So please welcome Lauren Murray. Hello, Lauren.
Hello, Lauren. I mean, hello, Jamil. It's really, really nice to be on your program for the first time.
Yes, it's a pleasure. It is such a pleasure. You did join us with Alfred, but you and I, this is our first solo broadcast, and I really am grateful that you have joined us. Your story is a very special one, and our listeners perhaps would like to hear a little bit of just how you came to challenge your reality and start this process of really questioning things.
Well, I grew up in a military family, and I just really thought that I was going to get married and have a white picket fence around the yard and, you know, three children and a dog and a husband, and I'd be driving a station wagon and wearing a car coat. And I went to university, to UC Davis in the 60s during the free speech movement and a tremendous social upheaval in the United States, and women began to go into careers that were non-traditional, and the non-traditional careers changed women, changed the opportunities for women, changed the awareness of women. Women got to use their intelligence and creativity, and then, of course, many women didn't marry in the 60s. They had children, but they didn't marry, and they chose not to, and that was another very dramatic change in the lives of women. It's not so good now for those women because they don't have any money. You have to be a widow, you know, to get the money. So what the lives that my mother and my aunts and my grandmothers had was very, very different. Women traditionally became nurses or teachers or social workers. And the women I know became astronauts. I became a geoscientist. I've been all over the world and had just my whole life has been a huge adventure. And I am a humanist, so always, 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 even as a young girl, I wanted to seek the truth and to educate people and to educate myself and to share knowledge with the people around me. And that's what eventually my life became, although in a very unique and an unusual way. And I worked in two nuclear weapons laboratories, the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, in the 70s and in the Lawrence Livermore Lab in the 90s, well, 89 to 91. And I became a federal nuclear lab whistleblower, which I wouldn't recommend to anyone. It's, it really does change your life. But as Gandhi said, very succinctly, he said, the miracle of the nuclear age is not how it changed the world, it's how it changes you. And I can say that working in those laboratories, becoming a federal whistleblower, and educating the global public about the dangers and the harm of nuclear pollution, which is killing our whole planet now, and changing the entire genome of planet Earth, which took 4.5 billion years to evolve to what it is. And it's been very, very, very significantly altered from nuclear bomb tests. Hiroshima and Nagasaki, of course, is when it started in 1945. Nuclear power plants, which has poisoned our food, the air in our houses. It travels globally and mixes completely in the global atmosphere in 1 year. And the depleted uranium and mini nukes that the U.S. introduced to the battlefield in 1991 in Iraq, all of these things have altered our lives in very, very devastating ways, which many people are not aware of. And most of all, it's destroyed the health of the global population, as well as all living things, plants, animals, bacteria, everything. So I became an educator. I became a scientist for the citizens and for the indigenous people instead of for governments and corporations. But first, I had to work in their house. I had to work in the nuclear weapons labs. I had to be a student in the universities to understand what that was about. Well, they're not educating people. They are training people for the workforce. And that's why we have state universities, the land-grant colleges that were established in the late 1800s under the guidance of two Skull and Bones men, the secret society at Yale, the Cheney and Bush and many other people in very powerful positions came from. And the money that started Skull and Bones came from the global dope enterprise, which started in the mid-1700s. I call it Dope Incorporated. And today, that drug economy is a hidden economy that involves five times more money than we know as the legitimate economy. All of the wars for the last 100 years, for the 20th century, were for Dope Incorporated. So it's been a very, very interesting, very educational, but not in the conventional sense, journey for me and for the people I've shared it with and from the people who've shared it with me. So it's wonderful to be on your program and to be able to talk about this and discuss it, because I know you're aware of a lot of it yourself from your own journey and personal experiences. So, Jamil, that's who I am.
Well, that's a lovely snapshot in covers a lot of ground in the conversation of women in the conversation of our political system, the system we see and the system we don't, and in the conversation of personal integrity, of somehow getting to that point where you realize, actually, who am I serving? And is it going to be something I want to live with if I continue in this path, knowing that I could be part of a force that's not helping humanity? There's a lot in the snapshot introduction of you, that you just offered us of your being, and how fun in a way that you could straddle the generations like that and be one of the women to make that change for us in a way that you've chosen to do that. And I'm just behind you, and you know, I've had to realize for myself more than once that the work that you've done, I've directly benefited from, though I didn't really see that transition until I became much older and, you know, basically bothered to turn around and look. And I think that that's a really important thing. It's certainly helped me in my education and how I've bettered myself, is to turn around and realize that the challenges that we're facing today and the potential for our tomorrow can be much easier to sort of take in with a longer picture, with a bigger picture in mind. You know, I think that when we hear the radiation, the devastation of the nuclear reality, if we only have that part of the picture, it's much more paralyzing possibly. But when we step back and look at a bigger picture, see that there's connections that we didn't realize, see that there is parts of the story that somehow resonate with what we can do. And somehow the bigger picture seems to open more opportunities for our understanding, hence our ability to make positive choices in this, because we all came here to, you know, we chose to come here, you know. So
right,
this is our work. We've come here to planet Earth somehow by whatever your cosmology dictates. Somehow we have all chosen to come here, and this is our situation, and we are here, and I am here, speaking more for myself, to make it a little better, you know, meet it where it's at and just don't leave it that way. That's kind of always been a little motto in our family. You meet them where they're at and don't leave them there, you know? When you're talking about the experience that you had in the Livermore lab and the discussion of the nuclear reality, do you feel comfortable sharing with us a little bit about what actually happens in a nuclear lab? You hit on something I think is very important, which is we don't really know. You know, we hear nuclear labs and we hear all, you know, but you made it clear that what is happening in the lab, they're not educating even the workers. But what is it like when you work in a nuclear laboratory? What do you see?
Well, I applied for a job at the Livermore Nuclear Lab because I was a single parent and I had a 2-year-old, and I knew someone there who I had worked with on the Berkeley campus when I was doing my master's degree there. And he helped me get a job, and I went through orientation, and you go through a week of sitting in a room with maybe 20 or 30 other new employees, and they discuss security at the laboratory, and they give examples of terrible security lapses. For instance, They work you to death there, and you're expected to do whatever you're told to do, and you're expected to work at any time that they need you to. And, of course, they pay you better than scientists normally are paid by governments and corporations. So people are crazy to get jobs there. I mean, they want them. Mm. And Once you start hearing the stories in the security briefing, you begin to wonder, what is this place really all about? And one of the stories that we were told in the security briefing was about a physicist who was married. He was probably in his 30s. And he was working late at night in the labs and everything and bringing lots of work home. And so he wasn't very available to his wife and family most of the time. And they just put you under tremendous pressure, and they squeeze every drop of intellectual material out of your brain that they can. Mm-hmm. And because they can't make these weapons and these horrible bombs and everything without these bright young minds. And so he told us this story about a young man whose wife finally said to him, "It's our fifth anniversary, and if you don't come home tonight and have dinner and we celebrate our anniversary, I'm going to divorce you." And they had two or three children. So he put his battered old leather briefcase on the back of his bicycle, and it had classified documents in it, which are never supposed to leave the classified area at the laboratory. And he rode his bike home, and when he got home, the briefcase was not on the back of the bicycle.
Oh.
Well, that really did ruin the anniversary dinner. And but it also really, really, really ruined the laboratory, because someone found it, the briefcase, in the middle of the road. It had fallen off his bicycle. And they had carefully taken out the classified documents that had classified stamped on each page. And they had taped them up in a store window, all of them, hoping that someone would come and find them or retrieve them. And it was some lab personnel or administrators or something who were having lunch and walked by this storefront and saw this whole window full of classified documents. So things like that happen every day there. It's that the security is nonsense. There really isn't any security. And this was confirmed in the late 80s or the early 90s when I was there, 89 to 91, when there was a panic at the laboratory because the Icemen were coming. And I said, "What in the heck are the Icemen?" And they said, "Oh, it's a special Department of Energy team. They haven't been here for 20 years to investigate security lapses and so forth." And so what the Department of Energy did was they sent a team of SEALs into each of the nuclear weapons labs with
Navy SEALs?
Navy SEALs? Navy SEALs. And they were told to get through the perimeter fence like they were breaking in, like they were terrorists, and to steal enough plutonium from the laboratory to make a bomb. So this Navy SEAL team came to Livermore. They had a wheelbarrow and wire cutters. They got through the perimeter fence. They got into the classified area, and they were able to put enough plutonium in their wheelbarrow to make a nuclear bomb and get out of the fence and off the lab property without being caught. So that's how good the security is.
For goodness sake. For goodness sake, Lauren.
And then I began meeting people, and there are a lot of Mormons working in the nuclear weapons labs. In fact, Jewish people and Mormons are overrepresented, which means they have some kind of a special interest in nuclear weapons and the nuclear weapons program. And I began meeting the people who worked there. And, of course, they put you through a social filter. You're watched all the time and tested and everything for 2 years. And then they decide whether to keep you as an employee or not. And one of the employees that I worked with, my lab partner, very succinctly put it this way. He said, well, the people who like to be controlled are the ones who are long-term employees here. And so it's a highly socially controlled atmosphere. One young woman in working in the department that I was in, Earth Sciences, had slept with every man in that department in order to keep her job and to finish her education. And there were Mormons, secretaries or Mormon physicists or whatever, who had been married four or five times, and their children from all these different men or different wives would come in and be in the office visiting their mother or their father, and they were all half brothers and half sisters. It was a crazy place. Mm-hmm. And basically there were rules laws and everything, but they were never enforced until they wanted to catch you. Or they wanted to fire you, or they wanted to demote you, or whatever. So it was an awful lot like being in the military. When I first went there and began working, I thought, God, this is just like living on a military base. Well, it's basically what it is. The Navy has 95% of the nuclear weapons, so the Navy has the greatest interest in monitoring and controlling and funding and so forth the nuclear weapons labs. So it was really hard to make friends. Everybody's afraid of everybody else and losing their jobs and everything. And it was just a really bizarre social environment. And then when I began investigating radiation, the health effects, the environmental effects, and so forth, the global effects, I began reading government documents and lab documents and Department of Energy or Atomic Energy Commission, the documents, and I realized that they didn't care about the workers at all. They were recruiting farm boys and ranch boys. Glenn Seaborg was this big, lanky, long-legged farm boy who was delighted to escape the farm life. And others were you know, Texas ranch boys who wanted to get off of out of the sun and out of that dusty, hellish life. And so they brought these young, naive, bright students and employees to the labs, and they just used them to mop up the radiation when it was spilled, and they had no protection. They even used their top physicists. They would send them in to clean up laboratories where a plutonium explosion happened. And one of the physicists who told me this, Andreas Tupadakis, he'd worked at Los Alamos and Livermore, and he said, oh, my God, a glove box exploded, and plutonium set off all the alarms in the building, and the laboratory was highly contaminated. And he said they just grabbed all the physicists and told them to go in there and mop it up. They had no protective gear or anything on. And I said, where were you? He said, oh, I was hiding in the bathroom, standing on a toilet with the door locked. I wasn't going to go and expose myself. And he said the poor man, a physicist, who was working with a glove box when it exploded, his boss drove him to a hospital, dropped him off, and then fired him.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
That's the climate. That's the lack of integrity. That's the modus operandi. That's just how horrible and nightmarish and dangerous those bomb factories are.
Well,
and
is it true?
People were educated, if they knew the truth about radiation and bombs and everything, they couldn't get anyone to work in their bomb factories, so they don't tell them anything.
Can you share with us the relationship between nuclear power plants that you, in the Grand Deception, it sounds really clear and it comes up over and over again that the nuclear industry, among other things, is solidly built on deception. From the very beginning, they were masters at deception and sending people to Mississippi when they asked for the corner store kind of strategy. And this, what you're telling us in the laboratory where your function was to develop bombs, was that the job of the Livermore Laboratory?
Oh, absolutely.
That was where you made the bombs or developed the theorems for the bombs or the...
Well, what they did was the Manhattan Project started at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory above the Berkeley campus.
Tell us a little bit about what the Manhattan Project actually is or was.
Okay, the scientists around the world began experiments and discovering fundamental science about energy, maybe in the 1700s and 1800s. And it started with chemistry first, and then Rentgen and Marie Curie and her husband. There were many nuclear pioneers, that's what we call them. And so they did not know the harm, the danger of radiation. And what Marie Curie and her husband did was they were extracting uranium from coal, because uranium naturally occurs in different earth processes. It's concentrated through earth processes. And so they had to do this for years, this very, very tedious extraction process to get the uranium atoms out of the coal. And it took years and years and years to do it. And, of course, they weren't wearing rubber gloves or masks or anything. They didn't know that it was biologically damaging. In fact, Marie Curie was doing it in order to develop technologies, radioactive technologies or nuclear technologies that would benefit humankind. And so she thought X-rays would be used to benefit humanity in terms of identifying diseases that you can't see any other way. And so they were dedicated to benefiting humanity. And what they didn't know is that that science is actually controlled by the bankers, the financiers. And the direction of science, the funding of the beginning of a science project in a new area of science is funded by financiers who then control the direction of the research and, most importantly, the application. And so the financiers were only interested in making more money. So that meant they had to extract that money from humanity, and so these technologies, when they are applied by financiers, do not benefit humankind. Mm-hmm. They create global poverty, global famine. Even Marx and Engels said global famine, global starvation, is a product of capitalism. So, at the end of the 1800s, there was not only a lot of research and interest and new discoveries, I mean Nobel Prize winning discoveries, very fundamental science in the nuclear arena, but also in energy technology such as Tesla's work. Tesla was I think he was Croatian, but he went to the University of probably Belgrade, And he ended up coming to the United States. And all those scientists who were madly working to discover how they could give energy for free to humanity, to the public, they were constantly hounded and funded in order to control them and their research by J.P. Morgan and other financiers, bankers. And when Tesla refused to sell a patent of his because he wanted to give free energy to the public, he wouldn't sell that patent to J.P. Morgan. So he had a meeting with J.P. Morgan, and by the time he got home back to his laboratory, just from the meeting, Morgan had already had his laboratory burned down. So being a scientist is actually an extremely dangerous occupation. Many scientists have been murdered. Tesla was murdered. 45 world-class microbiologists were murdered in the 2 years after 9/11, the World Trade Center and Pentagon disaster in 2002. There were also 75 or 100 scientists working at the Marconi Corporation in England. Well, they were working on basically discovering metals from space, and that means mining interests were interested in detecting minerals and metals from space, and they can do that now. They can do that with a 30-watt signal, which is about as much electricity as a 30-watt bulb uses in a sewing machine. And they can penetrate 150 miles down into the Earth from a satellite. They transmit a frequency, and it is changed to a different frequency, which is unique and characteristic to each metal or mineral that is subsurface or hidden under the Earth's surface. And they can actually scan from space across that ore body and with 100% accuracy. Wow. And determine how large it is. They can also scan across that ore body, and they can assay or determine the concentration of whatever they're looking for in the ore body, and then they can calculate exactly how much money they'll make off that ore body.
So
those 75 scientists who developed this technology were all murdered. So once they get the intellectual material, they just murder the scientists so that they can't undo it, or they can't tell anyone else.
Well, Bernard Eastland is one of them, perhaps, correct? The person who was very instrumental in particular phases of developing the HARP systems.
Bernard Eastland was a very brilliant scientist for an oil company. Which oil company?
I think it was ARCO.
ARCO, yeah. And or Richland, no, I can't remember the name of the exact company, but he devised this method, which is he also owned the patents or took out patents on some of his technologies, and the original concept for the design for HARP. And basically, it's capturing and manipulating the Earth's magnetic field in order to... he had a whole list in his own handwriting on the... It's on the Bernard Eastland site. Mm. And you can see his very first concepts for applications. and it was a missile shield so that you can weaponize the Earth's magnetic field and take down missiles, enemy missiles, before they even get to your country. And he also proposed using it for subsurface mineral exploration and Richfield, that's what it was, Richfield. And the oil companies were especially interested in that. But mind control and many other applications, tectonic warfare, he knew that the technology that he had discovered could be used to artificially trigger earthquakes, volcanic eruptions. He proposed using it to modify weather, and finally the oil company wrote a letter to the Undersecretary of Defense in the 60s and said, well, we have this new toy, and we think the military might be interested in it. And the Undersecretary of Defense invited the scientists to come to the Pentagon and do a presentation of their proposed new technology and the applications. And they immediately saw the military benefit, and so the research was well funded. And what I discovered is that it took me 5 years to discover who the partner in the United States was for with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union and the U.S. government were actually partners all through the Cold War in developing HAARP together. Hmm. And the reason that they needed each other, well, especially the United States needed Russia, was because the Russians had been doing scientific studies and sending scientific expeditions to gather data since 1898 in the Arctic. And I also discovered the reason that the nuclear bomb tests were done. So many were done. I mean, all they had to do was one at the Trinity test at Los Alamos, and they knew that, that they could build a bomb, and it worked. But you can't use them because you contaminate your own people, your own soldiers, and eventually the whole planet. And so I could never figure out why they did so many nuclear bomb tests. And huge ones. The Soviets did huge hydrogen bomb tests in the Arctic and contaminated all of the Arctic. The birds are flying around today. They eat the bushes and the leaves and the worms and the insects that live on them. And then they have radioactive guano, and these bird droppings that are radioactive eventually spread radioactivity all over the Arctic region. And the bomb test fallout came down through Canada and killed many, many, many babies, newborns and weak babies and elderly people and people who had compromised immune systems or compromised health. And eventually, in a year, that radiation is completely mixed in the whole global atmosphere, and it's rained out and snowed out, carried into the environment. It's carried by atmospheric dust all around the world, and the increase in chronic illnesses since 1945 are just horrendous. There was almost no diabetes, almost no cancer, before 1945.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, that's information that's very readily accessible, and that's information that is becoming more mainstream accessible. People are starting to notice their health isn't working, combined with the pharmaceutical allopathic modalities, there at this point, I'm really grateful to see there is some connections being made. But the radiation being the silent killer, as I've heard you say, the one that is not as obvious. You know, when weak babies die, we don't assume something on the outside, or it's not our first checkpoint, because we are not aware that this extraordinary amount of radiation has actually been released. And that's why a big, huge thank you to people like yourself for letting us know, because when we know that that's what we're dealing with, then we can actually address the situation more efficiently. You know, we can go around the hat a long way, but the bottom line is that the radiation is a major part of the degradation of the immune system of the entire planet, you might say it like that.
Well, I think that knowledge is very empowering, and I can assure you that doing this work and taking this issue up and working on it to the max and going to 50 countries and educating people about it has completely changed me and who I am. And I think that it helped to strip away the five generations of family expectations that every new baby is born under. Mm. And it helped it made me much stronger, and it taught me to trust myself, not to trust external authority. Trust yourself. If you need something done, do it yourself. Don't wait for other people to do it. Don't let other people do it. Do it yourself, because you'll do it the way it should be done for you. And basically, these financiers, these money people, they go back for thousands of years to Mesopotamia, some of the bloodlines, and the Roman Empire and the Egyptian Empire, and they've been around a long, long time. So in the mid-1700s, a man in England, an academic, and I think he was a preacher or minister or something, he wrote a book about a theory that the world was overpopulated. Well, certainly in the 1700s, the world wasn't overpopulated. What was he talking about? And so it had to come from the financiers, the bankers. And basically, their interest was in grabbing all the wealth and resources for themselves. And they could see that that people might demand or want to have a share in it, and they didn't want to share it. So they funded Malthus and told him what they wanted him to write. Universities were started by the financiers. The Royal Society of England, which set the tone and the parameters for Western science, was a London banker's product. And they knew, the bankers know, they have to use science to make lots of money. And so Malthus came up with this theory that the world was overpopulated. And as the population increased, they became more and more alarmed. And it was actually, after all the work that I've done in countries I've been in and collecting government vital statistics around the world, I've been able to show that all populations in all countries in the world have been declining since the 1950s. That's when nuclear bomb testing started. And wow. Well, they did some bomb tests starting in 1947, but not very much. It was really on testosterone by 1952. And the U.S. government did 1,300 bomb tests at the Nevada test site. So the United States is the most nuclear bombed nation in the world. And it caused an epidemic of conjoined twinning. These are Siamese twins joined at the the stomach or at the top of the head, they're joined together, or these are poor babies that were just mutilated by radiation.
Wow.
And conjoined twinning is very, very, very rare. But it suddenly started happening in humans and in animals in the 50s. And starting in about 1990 or 91 with the Iraq War, it started escalating all over the world, especially where the monsoon rain pattern, would rain out that radiation into the environment. And believe it or not, the monsoon rains and the monsoon rain pattern sort of originates in between India and Australia in those waters. Mm. And the rain patterns go in one direction. They go north through India. Then they can go west through Afghanistan, over Iran and Iraq and the Mediterranean, and they go across the Atlantic Ocean and rain out in the Gulf region, the Gulf of Mexico. That's why all of the Gulf Coast states, from Texas to Mississippi and Alabama, have the highest diabetes in the United States. It's the rain out of the uranium weapons and the radiation that has been released in the Middle East and Yugoslavia, Libya, Palestine, Israel. Israel is now, they have the fastest dropping fertility in the world.
Oh, wow.
So you can't, I mean, just a little dab will do you. One atom, one particle ejected from the nucleus of one uranium atom has the potential to start cancer. That's just one disease under the right conditions. One atom. And so what the Department of Energy and the National Institute of Health and the Centers for Disease Control have contrived is all of these very deceptive ways to hide the effects, environmental and health effects of radiation. And the Atomic Energy Commission was set up to do that and to regulate radiation and to promote nuclear power to cover up the effects and to control the scientists and the information. And the Atomic Energy Commission started the National Cancer Institute, the National Institutes of Health with the military, and the Centers for Disease Control. It wasn't to, those weren't to protect, and the EPA. And that was not to protect the people from radiation. It was to protect the government from the people finding out. And so I realized when I did a research paper on tropical glaciers when I was working on my PhD at UC Davis in the 90s, I did this paper on a very, very interesting glacier on the top of the Andes near Lake Titicaca. Lake Titicaca is in the Andes on the west coast of South America, and it's half in Bolivia and half in Peru. And no one could ever explain why the Indian population pre-Columbian, this is before Columbus came to the New World, why the population was 10 times higher than today. And so finally a team of geographers went down there, and soil physicists and anthropologists, and they studied the ancient Indian agricultural technology, and they recreated the beds, the plant beds, and they used indigenous crops, the indigenous potato, and they planted crops and tended them the way the ancient Indians did. And then they compared their yield at the end of the season to the crops that had been planted according to the dictates of the World Bank. And the World Bank ordered them to use chemicals and fertilizer and to plow and disc certain ways, very shallow plowing. And the ancient Indians had planted on raised beds. So those wide raised beds absorbed the heat of the sun all day. And then when it got cold at night, the heat would radiate from those raised beds all night long. And it was like a warm blanket that prevented the crops from getting frost damage. So when they compared the ancient agricultural yield to the modern bank yield, the ancient Indian technology produced 10 times more food. So that's why you had 10 times more people.
Wow, that is a direct correlation.
So another thing I discovered talking to a doctor who did emergency medicine on Indian reservations, he said a nurse friend of his had excavated burial grounds of pre-Columbian Indians and measured their height and determined their weight and compared their height and weight to Indians today. Well, most Indians, like most other people in the U.S., are overweight. Mm-hmm. And the ancient Indians were not. And what she discovered was the Indians today are the same weight, but they're much shorter because of malnutrition. And I said, aha. So the ancient food that was produced or hunted and gathered, had she determined, she measured it all scientifically, and she determined that the food value was 5 times more nutritious than the food value for the same items today. So actually, if we practiced ancient agricultural technology adapted to the microclimate wherever you're farming and to local indigenous plants, we could produce 15 times more food than is being produced under capitalism. And then I discovered Marx and Engels said in their writings that capitalism has produced global starvation and famine.
Well, I think another point on that in the capitalism versus the indigenous methodologies might be in my research and in my intuitive surveying, my analysis is in the indigenous way of life in general, it was very reciprocal. It was very much in communion with the earth and all living beings, and the understanding that our impact of however we did anything, whether we were cutting a tree or we were planting a seed, was going to impact not just us, but the community of beings that included every being, as well as the generations coming. An indigenous philosophy or indigenous integrity of being is much more grounded with a more mature, I would call it a more mature spiritual grounding in our place as a community member, whereas the capitalist model is contrary, as absolute as you might conceive, in that it is a get. It's the capitalist model on the spiritual levels is all about getting what I need, getting mine. I want more. I need more. It's about me getting my things done, my needs. It's all about me. There's never a consideration of anybody else. The success is celebrated when you get yours. You get your car. You get your whatever your material thing is. You know, the celebration, the whole paradigm is set up on getting mine, mine, mine. There's never a visit in the conversation of reciprocity or of communion or of responsibility. I think that's a very important part of that conversation as well, because that is the part of the conversation that we can, as as concerned citizens, address inside of ourselves, because these systems themselves are reflections of us, ultimately.
That's right. And the ancient people, indigenous people, always had in mind, because the women were the decision makers, and they were the decision makers because they had a vested interest in making sure their children survived and future generations were healthy and survived. And the men were the hunters and gatherers. They brought resources and food and things they provided to the, not just the family, but the nuclear family, but to the whole tribe. And so they were very, very cognizant of foods and herbs and medicinal plants, and my goodness, they were geniuses. They had everything they needed, everything they wanted. Everyone was healthy, almost everyone, and until they were old or they were injured. And also, inbreeding was absolutely one of the strongest taboos. And for instance, the Maori people and in New Zealand, even today, they tattoo all their generations, previous generations, on their face, on their chins. And Mongolians and Kazakhs, Central Asian people, they were tribal people who wandered. They are prohibited by tribal practices from intermarrying with anyone in, I think, the last 12 or 15 generations. So if you have any blood ties to a person in the last 10 or 15 generations, you absolutely cannot marry them. And then we look at the Rothschilds and these terribly wealthy financial families and interests. And the Rothschilds, since the mid-1700s, were ordered by Meyer Amstel Rothschild, the original father of 10 Rothschilds, 5 daughters and 5 sons, who set up the Rothschild Empire, but they're just a public face for the older bloodlines that don't want to be identified. And Meyer Amstel Rothschild ordered every single one of his children and all future generations to marry first cousins in order to keep the wealth in the family. And so they are inbred, they're insane, they have mental and other physical defects and aspects that are very undesirable in the interest of future generations. So they violated the laws of nature. And look what's happened. They're running the financial and other aspects of our global economy. It's a very, very unfortunate thing that this has happened, but the whole planet, all living things, are suffering from that violation of not intermarrying family members.
I saw this thing, a little video just yesterday about a 12-year-old girl who did a genealogy experiment in or a study in her school and got curious about the presidents. And so she connected using the matriarchal lines, which in traditional genealogy has to this point, at least at what we've been told, follows predominantly and only exclusively the patriarchal lines. But she got clever and followed the matriarchal lines and discovered that President Obama and George Washington, in fact, all of the presidents themselves have all a relation to King to the King of England, King George III.
Oh, I believe it.
They all
because
had...
Queen Elizabeth is she will soon be claiming the United States as her colony. She's already visited Ireland. No king or queen visited Ireland in 100 years, and she made her visit to Ireland not very long ago, dressed in green from head to toe, and it's all about claiming her kingdom. She's a sovereign ruler, and what a sovereign ruler is entitled to is all of the land. They own all of the people, and they own all of the mineral rights in their kingdom. So she owns the mineral rights, the people, and all the land in 27 countries and other countries in the Commonwealth. And I found this out when I was invited by a Canadian Parliament member to go up a few years ago and campaign against uranium mining, which was increasing in the Kootenays, which are one mountain range west of the Canadian Rockies. And ranchers and farmers were complaining to me that they'd wake up one morning and there was a uranium drilling rig out in their pasture drilling holes all over the place. Mm. And they couldn't stop them. And I said, of course you can't stop them. You only own the top 12 inches of dirt in the entire Commonwealth. Anyone who buys land is only getting title to the top 12 inches of dirt. And the Queen of England owns all of the mineral rights, everything below 12 inches from the surface. So who do you think is benefiting from the Marconi Corporation developing technologies that make it possible to map ore bodies, even subsurface, from space? It's the Queen.
Now, the Queen, this, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, you know, she's kind of like nuclear. She's the silent killer. She's the one that is permeating all of our lives, and we don't even know it. And
that's
we're
right.
We're not properly educated. Nobody tells Americans that, you know, the Queen of England actually owns your house. I mean, no, she doesn't own your house, but she owns 12 inches below your surface. You know, it's all these little intentional, you know, misgivings that
we're... Omissions, yeah.
The omissions. So how, as a Commonwealth that is waking up, the Queen of England is... one person, but she doesn't represent, she's more than just one person, isn't she?
Well, it's called the firm. It's actually it's a network of vested interests. They're all looters and plunderers and exploiters. They're parasites, basically, but they all work together. So it's the financiers, it's the mining interests, it's the food producers, it's the church. Everything is all tied into that industry. And, for instance, it's the politicians who get into office and are selected. They're filtered and then selected and then funded by these vested interests. Queen Elizabeth herself gave $500 million to Obama for his first election 2 years before the election. And you just had to notice how she kissed Obama's wife and Obama when she was greeting them in Buckingham Palace. They've made a number of visits to Buckingham Palace. And Queen Elizabeth has gone overboard welcoming them. And we now know why she put $500 million into Obama becoming president. And, of course, he gets a list of tasks that he has to complete with that office. And I knew he would be reelected because she's not through with him. Mm. He's got more work to do for her. And it's going to be the unification of North America and the poverty imposed on Americans. This country is going to be completely destroyed. and the middle class is being dismantled now. Basically, jobs and factories have all been sent overseas, a lot to China, and they're looting America now. The Vietnam War was where a lot of the programs were set up and tested by the military that are now being implemented in the U.S. in the takedown of the U.S., breakdown and takedown. And, for instance, in January, Jesse Ventura did an interview with me on the TSA X-ray machines and the nightmare that our airports are now. And the producers told me before the interview started, I flew up to Minnesota, and they said, Loren, we're giving you 5 minutes. At the end of this show, nobody else gets that much time who's in this program, this segment, and we expect a big bang from you to end this segment. And I said, well, that's fine. I always deliver. And so we did the interview, and then I said, oh, at the very end, Jesse, you're a Navy SEAL, right? He said, yes. And I said, you're in Vietnam, right? And he said, yes. And I said, do you know what the Phoenix program is? And he said, yes. And I said, well, that was the, well, for the listeners today, the Phoenix program in Vietnam was the U.S. military setting up death camps, assassination teams, torture chambers, and it was to destroy civilian support of the Viet Cong resistance, Ho Chi Minh and his people. And I said, well, the Phoenix program is Homeland Security, and Colonel Tom Ridge, the first Secretary of Homeland Security, was in the Phoenix program in Vietnam. Also, Project Popeye was weather modification, the early experiments by the military in Vietnam on weather modification, using chemicals spread in the skies, the chemtrails. They did it in Vietnam to cause huge rains along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, so that supplies could not be transported to the Viet Cong resistance. So so much that the military is doing, they're doing it in other countries as precursors to introducing it here in the U.S.
And I believe we could even see it now being used. What has happened in New Jersey recently, the declaration of martial law. And the controlling of the electricity, which for me, I just had this feeling that, you know, somebody has a switch and they're just not turning it on.
And well, There was recently an article by a Russian who'd lived in the Soviet Union, and he wrote a very interesting article recently comparing what happened in Russia prior to the takedown of Russia, of the Soviet Union, which collapsed in about 1993. And what he described was rolling electricity blackouts. That was something that started happening. It's very disrupting, of course. But they just tore the fabric of the social fabric apart and destroyed trust and everything in the Soviet Union in order to collapse it. That's what's happening in the U.S. now.
When we compare the Russian and the American, I wonder if you've done any analysis about the Russians at that point were under communism, right? And in America, yes. We are taught that communism is the opposite, the big, bad, ugly other. And I'm curious if you have done any analysis about how the people themselves were able to deal with that or in what you might have in comparison to what America as the born and bred, you know, capitalist, I am me, all about me, might be different as we are actually in that process.
Well, What's happening to the United States is the Sovietization of this country. And when I was at Livermore Lab from 89 to 91, my lab partner said one day, "Oh, Loren, there are two Soviet KGB generals here at Livermore Lab." I said, "Well, I thought we were at war with Russia, with the Soviet Union. What are they doing here?" He said, "Well, they're transferring the technologies of political control that were used in the Soviet Union to control the people. They're transferring it to the United States government through the Livermore Lab." And I said, "What are they doing that for?" And he said, "Well, they're going to turn the United States into the Soviet Union and the Soviet Union into the United States." And that's exactly what's happening now.
Can you break that down a little bit more, in that the Soviet Union being the communist, now America being the communist, and then Russia now being the capitalist? Is it on that
level?
Well,
basically, communism means no land ownership. The government controls and dictates everything, probably even sometimes who you marry. People living on communes in the Soviet Union. It was extremely inefficient because there was no incentive or reward for working hard. So I went on expeditions, botanical expeditions, all over the Soviet Union, even into Georgia and Armenia. And I saw people living under the Soviet system in poorly built, poorly constructed, very sterile buildings and apartment blocks, poorly built. And they were growing food in the strips down the middle of roads, the strips that divide the lane directions. And you'd go into a restaurant. I was with two other scientists. We'd go into a restaurant in Georgia, maybe up in the mountains or in a big city or whatever, and we'd sit there for 2 hours, and the waitresses were sitting over in a corner at a table talking. They never even brought us menus. And the food was horrible. You never knew what you were going to get because they didn't even have what was on the menu. So finally, this Russian girl came over to our table, and I said, "Why did you take so long to come to our table?" And she said, because it doesn't make any difference whether we wait on you or not. We're not rewarded for it. We're not paid for it." There was no incentive. I mean, a society survives on the power of its ideas. So does a community. So does a family. But there was no incentive for ideas. There was no outlet for them. There was no nothing receptive for them. They didn't want people to do anything except what they were told to do. And some of those Russian scientists, when the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 1990s, they came to Berkeley, where I was a staff scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, and I met them. And they looked like they had been tortured from the day they were born until the moment they were sitting in that office and I was looking at them and talking to them. It was horrific.
Wow.
It was torture chambers. It was control by fear and famine. And there was just nothing for the individual. And that's what they're turning us into.
And it's very subtle, and it's been a long time, you know, in the process. That's why learning history, you know, is really helpful. The mind control of America has crossed my meditation a lot, and it actually has helped me grow a lot of compassion for America, and the, you know, the lot of the world community laughs at America. They call us stupid. They think, you know, we're just asleep and insolent and completely indifferent, you know, and
the ugly American is all of those things.
Yeah,
and a lot of Americans are very ugly Americans. I mean, in terms of how they behave in this country and when they travel to other countries.
Absolutely.
That's actually a very accurate, the ugly American is a very accurate description of many Americans.
It is true.
They don't know anything about other cultures. The culture that they think is reality that they get from TV and the media is and the internet now doesn't even exist. There is no such thing as security. There's no such thing as security anywhere. They're buying insurance and they're trusting in politicians who are basically representing no change. Whether Romney or Obama was elected president doesn't matter. It's irrelevant whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. It's David Rockefeller who gets reelected as president of the United States in every single election.
The agenda moves forward.
Yeah, and his agenda is no change from the last president. They want their policies, which are dictated through the Council on Foreign Relations, to be carried out, and they don't want any change from administration to administration. And what in the world is Angelina Jolie doing as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations? She's CIA.
She's a heavy
represents a model woman now. She's a heroin addict. She said, well, that's Brad's now. She's been a heroin addict for a long time. They have all these adopted children and their own children. It's a blended family, and it's a model for American women now to emulate and to follow.
Well, and that is part of the mind control.
Absolutely, it is.
That is part of the mind control, and the part of the mind control that works on our sacred psyche, I call it, the inner being, that if we're not aware of that, it's like the most sacred part of ourselves, this inner part where our inner part meets our outer part. And
it's our
spirituality,
yes, it is.
Yeah, and those are the things that directly impact our behavior in ways we are not conscious of if we don't become conscious of them. We can become conscious of them. We can educate ourselves like we're doing now and realize that this is the model being brought to us. Another similarity on that is this idea that the Queen of England, like there's this, another one of the ways that we're conditioned in this conversation I can see really clear is this idea of the lone gunman, right? This idea that heinous things only happen because one person gets completely screwed up on a really bad day kind of thing. When really, it's a very developed network. It's a very well thought out plan. It's a very logistically organized execution to meet another goal that is never discussed. And I think that's really important, because in the mind control, that's where we're controlled, is that part that's never discussed, right?
Right. That's right. Now, What Queen Elizabeth, and actually it's the Anglo-Dutch monarchies, it's Queen Elizabeth of England and Elizabeth Windsor, and Queen Beatrice of the Netherlands, and they represent actually the legacy and the continual operation of the East India Company and the Dutch East India Company. And they were set up in the 1700s by the financiers, and it was to bring spices and items for commerce to that could be sold in their countries in Europe and North America and charged very high taxes on them. So they were companies set up to loot and rape and steal and do land grabs and genocides and to enrich people who had no claim to other countries with lots of natural resources. So the East India Company and the Dutch East India Company were the creators of the Global Dope Incorporated project, and they began. They wanted to trade with China. Now, Britain had the Industrial Revolution in the 1700s, and they wanted to take their manufactured goods and trade them with China for Chinese porcelain, Chinese silk, and Chinese tea, because they could sell them for very high prices. There was one source for them, and people in far away had no way of getting these items from China except through the Dutch East India Company and the East India Company. And the Chinese said, yes, we will trade with you, but we're 5,000 years old, and we have everything we need, and we really don't want any of your junk manufactured in your industrial revolution, because we have much better products that we make ourselves. However, we will sell you porcelain, silk, and tea if you pay in gold or silver. So the British reluctantly began to pay in gold and silver, and then they said, wait a minute. The London financiers said, no, we don't want to give China all our gold and silver. So what we do have is a military, and we will go to India, and we will take over India militarily and use the Himalayan foothills to produce opium, and we'll store the opium balls in warehouses all over India, and we will sell the opium to independent sea captains who have fast clipper ships and can transport the opium to China, and they'll have fast clipper ships to outrun pirates and so forth on the high seas. And then they can bribe customs officials in China to trade the opium for the goods we want. And by the year 1900, listen to this, 250 million Chinese were completely addicted to opium.
The new drug.
The new drug. And so finally, the Chinese, after 150 years of struggling to get Britain out of China and opium out of China and out of the Chinese, they finally were able to kick the British out around 1900, and they prohibited young people from getting addicted to opium, but they allowed the older people who were hopeless, you can't get them off opium, just to slowly die. So by about 20, 20, 25 years after 1900, world opium production had declined drastically, and by the Vietnam War, it was almost zero. So the British wanted Vietnam as a new source of opium because they were planning to create a new opium industry, heroin addicts all over the world, to revive the opium trade. And the headquarters are, since the 1700s, are in Hong Kong. It's called Jardine and Matheson. There's almost always been a British chief of police in Hong Kong. And World War II was about Dope Incorporated, and the British and the U.S. had agreed to split China when World War II was over, and each would take half of it. However, the British made a secret deal with Mao Zedong, And he became the British partner in the doping incorporated revenue and production and everything. And all they did was use the multi-generational Chinese families that had been distributing the opium since the 1700s. Well, they're still the same families, are still the distributors all over the world. And and so as soon as Vietnam happened, world opium production started going up. And in about the 1960s, Zhou Enlai, who was a high government official in China right under Mao Zedong, he had a conversation with President Nasser of Egypt, and he said, "We are going to take down America the same way America and Britain took down China, with drugs, with heroin, with opium. And we are helping American soldiers in Vietnam get addicted to heroin. They'll go back to the United States and increase the heroin trade and addicts, and that's how we're going to take down the U.S. And I live in Berkeley, California. The UC campus at Berkeley, the student body is over 52% Chinese. And they are being trained, as well as non-Chinese students and foreign students, to be CIA assets. They're being trained in these technologies of political control, which they can transmit through their computers and from their homes, through and apartments, through antennas, secret antennas. And they are training a whole new cadre of operatives, young operatives, to aid in the transformation of this entire planet. And it's not just UC Berkeley. It's universities all over the world are part of this training, the young people for that transformation.
And I see...
And Brzezinski wrote a very important book. Brzezinski works with David Rockefeller. He started the Trilateral Commission, and he wrote a book called Between Two Ages. And that is exactly where we are now. We're in a transformation between two ages. And the age that we're leaving is an age of humanism and social norms things that are normal human beings are accustomed to and practice, music, art, poetry, things like that. And they are transforming to it's a robotic society. It's a totally mind-controlled slave society. And Brzezinski wrote all about it.
That's the big Brzezinski. And
yes,
he also, and he's also one of Obama's mentors or controllers or something like that. Is that correct?
Oh, Obama was a student at Columbia University. Obama is third-generation CIA. His mother was CIA. She worked for the UN in Southeast Asia. His father was CIA. She met him at the East-West Center at the University of Hawaii, which was a CIA training ground for the new leaders of African countries when they got their freedom from colonialism. All they did was train the new leaders by the CIA at the East-West Center and other places. Mm-hmm. And they became CIA agents and leaders in the new former colony, African colonies. So then she divorced him, and she went to the East-West Center and met her next husband, who was from the wealthiest family in Indonesia. He was in the military. He was an Indonesian colonel, and he participated in the overthrow of Sukarno, the legitimate leader of Indonesia. And Obama actually lived in Indonesia for a while and had a half-sister through him. And Obama's grandmother was the first woman vice president of any bank in Hawaii. Well, she was CIA funding all of the overthrow of legitimate governments in Southeast Asia to be replaced by CIA puppets. And his grandfather had been former military intelligence. Well, he was still military intelligence. Mm-hmm. He was supposed to be a furniture salesman in Honolulu. But what was he doing in photos at the CIA East-West Center greeting Obama's future father when he arrived in Hawaii? What was Obama's grandfather doing there if he wasn't CIA? He was CIA. And Wayne Madsen, who has a very good website and blog and everything, he was former naval intelligence, and he was in the NSA, the satellite people. So he's got a lot of contacts. He went to the CIA archives, and he thoroughly researched Obama and the history of his family. He wrote a 5-part series exposing all of them with photos, with CIA documentation. All of them are CIA, or were CIA operatives.
Well, that is very important information to assimilate, or at least to have an open mind to explore, because I find one of the biggest challenges in our consciousness in the collective to looking at the takeover, breakdown,
Breakdown and takedown,
which is on speed right now. It's definitely happening, and it is filtering. It is infiltrating conversation, common conversation. More and more people are noticing, a lot of things are off here. But until we can really have an understanding that the person who we think is the president is actually part of a larger network that has an agenda to do just that, to take it down and break it down, and who is that actually serving? And I think that this is an important time to also bring into light, you use the analogy of the change of the world in the Brzezinski agenda, which is one
transfer.
Between the two worlds of the what we would have called or assumed more humanist to the more robotic, just to summarize.
Transhumanism. I couldn't remember what it was. It's called transhumanism.
Right. Transhumanism, which philosophically is grounded in the idea, the belief that the human has reached its maximum evolution because it's all material-based. It sees the human as only a material unit. That the soul inside, the heart inside, which is where poetry and music and these things evolve from, obviously are not important. They're not a part of the asset of the human species. The transhumanism is very grounded in thinking material is it, and because the human body has reached some level of what they think is all it's going to get, then the next thing it can do is just become a really good computer. That actually the goal is to have this total surrender to this outside force that dictates your whole reality, because that's really the best thing that a human can be. And, you know, that's fine. On one level, I believe that everybody has a choice, and that is an option, and that the universe is a really big place, and there are other options. And I do believe that there are other agendas going on right now that have other ideas for humanity, because on another level you can step back and say, well, look, we have had huge victories as a species. Just the fact that we have survived this long, I think, is huge. I think it's amazing that humanity has evolved at all with all these obstructions to our natural process, you know, and the fact that we're talking in 2012 about whether we should feed the hungry is absurd to me on one level, because how could we not feed the hungry, you know? But yet, if we weren't talking about it all this time, there would be a lot more people who were hungry, right? So,
yes.
It's amazing the uphill battle that we have fought. But I do also see that on another level, it hasn't even begun to explore the another gift of the human when we look at it from the human as a species, and that the core operative is non-local, that it's in the soul, that it's in the cosmology, that the human has not been allowed to develop freely here. And there's another idea that the human has this potential opening up now. And I really feel that that is really the ultimate goal for humanity. What the road is, I don't know, but I really feel like there's room for everybody. If you want to be a, you know, give your body to the computer thing, do it, have a good time. But there's some of us that really have another idea, that it's really time to just be more of who we really are in our connection to all that is, to the cosmos, to the betterment of humanity, that to some of us, we're ready to just feed everybody and really get on with expressing the beauty of life. And I feel like those doors are also opening to us. And an important part of opening those doors is looking at where we are now, which is why we have to have these conversations. We have to look at the fact that we have been a controlled species, you know, that we have been in this box and manipulated and controlled, and our moments of, quote, freedom have been few and far between, and to be celebrated with full force, right? But we haven't got there yet, you know?
Right.
So talk to me about this idea of what we can do. When I think it's really important, we're coming to our last time as the time has gone by. We are a species now that I think in part is perplexed. I guess I'm really speaking to America today, because I feel a lot of concern about what is happening in America. I feel a lot of concern that so many Americans still are just, you know, looking at the I, me, mine agendas, still overwhelmed by their own struggles to survive, which is all reasonable, you know, without judgment. But the fact is that there is a much bigger plan happening really fast, and that it is really important for us to make a move. So how could we make a move that you see with all the experience and all the places that you've been? What would be a most proactive move for us? And I know the part of we need to be honoring our truth. And also, how can that be manifesting in our world?
Well, when I began to study the nuclear project, which was in the year 2000, I spent 18 hours a day studying physics and chemistry and environmental science and microbiology, and it was with a former Manhattan Project scientist. He wanted me to be a spokesperson for him and others who opposed atmospheric testing and did not believe the public should be poisoned by weapons testing. And he said, "You're a woman, and you can go around the world and go to countries I can't go to," because he's still classified, and you can warn people about, "I'm going to teach you all about this." So he spent 12 years teaching me in his house, in his living room, all about the whole nuclear project. And that was so horrific for me. After about 8 years, I just went, "Oh, well, I just can see that this wasn't accidental, poisoning the whole world. It's absolutely deliberate. Of course they knew what they were doing." Mm-hmm. And it was definitely the goal. And all of the nuclear technologies, they have vital statistics in most governments around the world. So certainly they noticed cancer, diabetes, birth defects, increasing brain disease, heart disease, increasing exponentially with the introduction of every new nuclear technology. Mm. And And so I was really in shock. I mean, it took me 8 years to work through my own denial that humans could actually deliberately create this project. And then I began to ask, well, who's behind it? And one day I was sitting at my computer and I did a Google search on University of California plus Skull and Bones. Well, I am still going down that rabbit hole. And what I've realized is that the bomb tests were necessary to study the ionosphere by injecting huge amounts of radioactive particles into the Earth's magnetic field and observing how they behaved. That was Bernard Eastland's experiment. And then once they understood how the ionosphere behaved scientifically, then they were able to develop the applications, the mind control. The monkey colony at UC Davis is where they did the animal studies. And I have a photo in 1964 of Edward Teller, Dr. Strangelove from Livermore, standing next to Vice President Nelson Rockefeller at the dedication ceremony of the Applied Science Facility at UC Davis. That's where they adapted the animal studies for human application. Then I interviewed a man, former Army guy, who had been kidnapped as a child by the MKUltra program, CIA, and he had been experimented on until he was a young adult in the safe house in Livermore, and they were doing mind control experiments on many children. They were kidnapped. Some of them were murdered. They were buried in the vineyards in Livermore. It was horrific. It was so inhumane and criminal. And yet they were able to carry all of that out in the United States without any problem. And then I was talking to Nick Begich, who was one of the first people to report on HAARP in Alaska. He lived up there, and his father was a member of Congress. He was murdered and with Senator Hale Boggs in a plane crash in Alaska when they started helping the Indians conserve and preserve their natural resources that they were given by the U.S. government as reparations for all their lands that were stolen. And Nick said, well, I think the real purpose, the real underlying purpose, the real goal of creating HAARP is to destroy the spirituality of humanity. And I agree with him. And most people are not aware of the HAARP technology. They're not aware of the mind control technology. But that sure is what those two Soviet KGB generals were transferring to the U.S. government at Livermore, and it's also what was being developed at the monkey colony at UC Davis. And so people who don't know something is possible, it's very hard for them to believe it, that it's happening. And I think that education now, programs like yours, there's so much on the internet now and YouTube that even U.S. News and World Report, Alfred Weber told me recently, was mentioned in their coverage of Hurricane Sandy that many people on the internet believed it was a man-made event. Now, when did HAARP ever get into the mainstream? I've never heard it mentioned in the mainstream. It's all in the alternative news, which is on the internet. So you see, we are making a change. We are making people aware. And it empowers people, and it protects their spirituality. And it's the younger people, the children now, and the babies who are being destroyed by the Fukushima radiation that really concern me. We have a corporate memory because we know what it was like before this nightmare project. But what about the children and the babies and the unborn babies? They won't even have the mental capacity that we have because they're suffering brain damage in utero from their parents being exposed to radiation and ingesting it and inhaling it while these fetuses are being carried by the mother. So a lot of people are going to be hurt by this, but as the lesson of Hiroshima and Nagasaki taught us, and I've been on 20 speaking tours in Japan since 2000, so I know Japan quite well. The miracle of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was that it transformed many things in Japan, including medicine. Oh. And they found new ways. They didn't have blood to give the Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors blood transfusions. So the doctors used seaweed juice. They made juice out of seaweed because it represents salt water, and salt water and blood. Blood represents the salt water that life used to live in, and it carries nutrients and oxygen around the bodies of living things or leaves or whatever, carbon dioxide. And so there are going to be a lot of new changes, transformations, improvements, discoveries, because we have to do it.
That's a great story. That's fantastic to realize the human invention is really astute in these times when it's really pushed up against the wall, but also that these things really help us know that there is, and perhaps some of us realize, wow, there always was a solution. And it just really helps us to know what it is we are working to solve. And we have a great world of destruction right now. You know, a lot of cat and mouse games going on, a lot of, learn your information is just such a gift. I am so grateful that you have come here to share, because you really, you put things very well, but you also, you're more than a statistician, you know, and you're really comfortable sharing your experience. And I think that that for me personally really brings it home, you know, that makes it a lot more accessible to a lot of people who appreciate information in that way, you know, because
well, we
you
need
can read.
To... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, we just need to rediscover who we are. We need to reach down and feel ourselves, and we need to begin to love ourselves and to love mm-hmm. each other. And you have to love yourself before you can love other people. And the power of that love creates miracles. That's mm-hmm. all we need. Love is all that we really need. And it brings everything else that the universe provides to us without even asking for it. It's just suddenly there. And I discovered in doing this work, it's a process that you go through, letting go of the false things that we believe in that are real. They've been created by people who want to control us. And when you begin to rely on yourself, if you need something done, do it yourself. And then it gets done the right way and the way you need it to be. People should be gardening. They should be bartering. Get off the chessboard of the financiers. We don't need their phony money. Mm-hmm. We were trading and bartering before the capitalism was even invented.
Mm-hmm.
So why not return to that? I have a little herbal store in Berkeley called Lhasa Karnak, and my house is a safe house for many different kinds of people. And when they come to my house and they're sick or ailing or whatever, I call up Lhasa Karnak, and there are all these nice women, young women who work there. And I'll say, oh, this Native American has reflexive acid, a problem with his stomach. Do you have some herbs that will cure that, that will help that, relieve him? Oh, yes, I have this and this and this. We have this and this and this. And I said, okay, I'm sending him down right now. His name is blah, blah. Please give him what he needs. And so this Native American will come back with 4 little bags of herbs, and all he has to do is make tea once a day and drink it, and that reflexive acid, whatever it is, disease, it suddenly stilled and calmed, and he can have a normal day. And I've done this for myself, for cats, for animals, for sick people, and all we need is to know the leaves and the plants around us in our neighborhood or in the city or whatever, and all our medicine is there. Mm. It's hanging above our heads, or it's growing from the earth. And what's happened is the financiers have taken over medicine and weapons, and they're using illegal weapons to make us sick so they can sell their useless pharmaceuticals to us. And just to prove it, just to prove they're in cahoots and that it is the pharmaceutical companies and the bankers in cahoots, in Northern California, up in north of San Francisco, in an area called Rohnert Park and Sonoma County, there was a big dispute in the town of Sebastopol because a car dealership was being sold, old car dealership that had gone out of business. The land was, the owners wanted to sell it to Chase Bank and CVS Pharmaceutical Company to build a bank and a pharmacy. Well, if they're not owned by each other or somehow linked, why are they buying the same piece of property?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there we have, they're taking our good health, which our Constitution guarantees. It's our right as human beings, as citizens of America, to good health. And they're stealing our health and replacing it with bad health, with illness, with long-suffering illnesses, not just in us, but it's destroying future generations, the viability. And they're replacing it with chemicals. Pharmaceuticals are probably made from the petroleum products. So, and they own all the petroleum companies. Queen Elizabeth personally owns British Petroleum. So who did the Gulf disaster? It was Queen Elizabeth.
Mm. You know, that's very interesting. And we could have, I don't know how many shows talking. We've come to a fork in the road where I see where we could talk a lot more about the spiritual aspect of this and the mind control. We could go down the road of more clarification about how we identify our native environment and also the innovation that comes when we face our nuclear reality and move forward with the solution. And then we also have, in just this brief chat with you, we have this whole area of the British Crown and these controlling families and the legacy of the financiers and the way they've been working in the background this whole time that we have been on this planet, and, you know, definitely not taught to us in school. You know, the very, very important information, very important new ways of looking and thinking about things that you've brought to us to help us.
Jamil, it's simple. Do you know how we stopped atmospheric testing in the United States? It was John F. Kennedy. And what happened is little old ladies in tennis shoes surrounded the White House with baby buggies, and there was media coverage all over the world. That ended atmospheric testing. Just get out there and do something.
Huh. Well, that is very straightforward, and that is something that most people might be able to get their head around. And I really believe that that is what the times ahead are going to be knocking on so many doors requiring of us to make that choice, because if we don't make that choice now, we could well end up with that bizarre idea that's being pushed forward about the highway across the country, and we could well end up in fascist reality much more than certainly America has ever conceived it was possible. I mean, and sometimes I wonder if America doesn't have to become the lockdown reality, even if brief, so the consciousness of humanity in America gets it that we really do need to address the controlling system to truly achieve freedom. I wonder about the process here.
The sad thing is that Americans are the least prepared. People in other countries have gone through centuries and millennia of wars. Mm-hmm. America is a new country. It's not even 300 years old. And HAARP was turned on for the first time on July 4th, 1976, the 200th anniversary of the United States of America. So if anybody thinks we're not the target and they're not taking down this country, that's a real good indicator. Mm-hmm. And what Putin said, the present president of Russia, and he was a KGB operative spy during the Cold War, he said, this project of the New World Order will never work. A lot of people are going to be hurt, but this will never work. And I believe him. Mm. I think he's a very wise and a very experienced man. And he worked during the heydays of the Soviet Union, and that didn't work. Mm. So how could a global Soviet Union work?
Yes.
It's too insane, it's too badly planned, it's planned for the wrong reasons, and anyway, destroying things never creates wealth. If they created prosperity and a positive economic model, they could create much more wealth and not have to steal it through schemes and lies and wars.
Exactly. And that's pretty much their whole job, as this is another conversation related that is really important too. The intention all along was to create destruction, because it was very specifically to oppose the natural order, to
that's
oppose
right.
the life-giving force, to somehow
right.
usurp it and use it for their own benefit, to control the species and the entire planet. So it's actually been working well. This is actually what their end game has been all along.
Yes, and what gets you through insanity, because this is truly an insane scheme planned by insane people, and I mean clinically insane, is right conduct. And if each person who has... We have no control over anyone else. We only have control over ourselves. If each person conducts themselves in a correct way or the right way, then this is impossible.
Absolutely. If each one of us takes a minute to stop and think about what we're doing, think about everything that we're doing, from how we're going to respond in the store to the choices we're going to make about jobs, if every one of us stops and thinks about what we're doing, to actually choose the right thing rather than allow ourselves to be on that wheel of so busy and doing this and oh, I have to survive, you know, getting caught up in all the choices, letting all the choices be made for us, then
all the distractions.
Yep.
Caught up in all the distractions. So, Jamil, it's just really been wonderful. It was really wonderful to do this interview. Thank you very, very much. And I'd like to thank the audience for listening, and I hope that people feel empowered and not frightened, and that they begin to do their own research. That is where the empowerment comes, because then you own the information, and you become a great salesperson passing that information around, because you know it's real. It's your information. It's not secondhand. It's not from a TV program or a newspaper that's full of lies or whatever. You've done the research yourself, and people will believe you because they know you're sincere.
Thank you so much, Lauren, for joining us. We have topped the hour, and it has been a pleasure. And you have all been listening to the Alchemy of Light broadcast. And I want to take a minute to also thank all the ancestors that have gone before us and brought us this opportunity to make these choices right now, and to thank all those powers of that be in spirit and other forms who have joined us in this broadcast, and to thank BBS Radio, back of the house, front of the house. Thank you guys so much for making this possible as well. And thank you all listening. Thank you so much for caring to take some time and to share this 2 hours with us. And we will sign off for now. Be back in a fortnight. So do take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other. Until next time. Bye-bye.